No one sat at the head of the conference table, but Annie's father sat at the center of its length, Kroenberg the Nazi seated directly across from him. There was no special order to the seating arrangement other than that. And Annie Rourke Rubinstein had nothing to do but listen. She could have done nothing else had she tried.
I'm empowered, Lieutenant General, to negotiate with you on behalf of the interests of the Trans-Global Alliance. As James Darkwood has told you, we're interested in your help in obtaining the tactical nuclear weapons under the control of the Nazis and Eden forces, led by Dietrich Zimmer. In exchange, we will aid you in deposing Dr. Zimmer and establishing yourself in his stead. To that end, then, what do you suggest?
Our interests are indeed parallel, Doctor. We both believe that without the tactical nuclear warheads at Dr. Zimmer's command, the entire world may well be doomed to destruction. I would rather not see that happen. Aspirations to power are always subject to death. No, it would be very stupid of me to willfully allow the destruction of this planet when I can assist in saving it. We will be enemies, Doctor, should we both succeed.
We are enemies now, sir, but united in this moment in time by a common cause. And that cause is resolved. Each of us will doubtless be interested in assuring the death of the other. That is to be expected.
You are admirably candid, Dr. Rourke, and I shall be candid as well. The one assurance I request, and I trust your personal integrity that it will be honored, is that once the nuclear warheads your scientists required are transferred, neither these nor any other nuclear weapons will be utilized in a fight against me.
You have my word, sir, and though I'd be damning my own soul, I would fight beside you if need be in order to make certain that the bargain is kept.
Your word is all the assurance I need, Dr. Rourke. So I will brief you and the others,
Please.
Kroenberg leaned back from the table, drawing his hands together over his abdomen.
And this pledge of Dr. Rourke is something all of you will also honor?
Yes.
The others nodded. Annie caught Emma Shaw's eyes, a little look of panic in them as she nodded her agreement as well.
Very well. I shall reveal something concerning Dietrich Zimmer about which Allied intelligence has no knowledge. The good doctor prides himself on being prepared for any contingency.
An otherwise admirable trait.
Ah, indeed, Dr. Rourke, indeed. However, you shall find this contingency plan less than admirable, I think. Indeed, I know. You must realize first that Dietrich Zimmer is wholly dedicated to the classic Nazi ideal, that of the master race. For his purposes, however, such can be achieved is a justification unto itself. His original plan, involving the clones of yourselves and of himself and Martin Rourke Zimmer, was to entrap you, Dr. Rourke, into serving his will. I learned of this plan only after the destruction of our base in the Himalayas and the concurrent deaths of the clones stored there. I was, I will admit, shocked by the plan's audacity. Your wife, Dr. Rourke, how is she? She is not with you, I see.
Well, though it is a personal matter, suffice it to say that my wife and I have been experiencing marital difficulties since before the night of the war. We've each found someone else. My wife and I will soon divorce. The paperwork's already being accomplished. And as you no doubt know, Sarah Rourke underwent a terrible ordeal from which she is still recovering.
I have unearthed information which may relieve your mind of some nagging doubts, Dr. Rourke, regardless of your situation with your wife. The woman whom you think is Sarah Rourke is, indeed, the genuine Sarah Rourke. Dietrich Zimmer had wished to use her to destroy you. He programmed her to believe that you were responsible for shooting her in the head that fateful night in what is now Eden City, but more than a century ago. He involved her with Martin. Incidentally, you only killed the clone of that rather repugnant young man. The original is still alive. Dietrich Zimmer used Martin to further persuade your wife that you should die. With a memory of you attempting to murder her, I believe Major Chemerovna was suggested as the likely motive. With a memory, as the good Dr. Zimmer altered it, and her living third child before her, in obvious jeopardy from you, since you were enemies, he may well have pushed her over the brink. You should be wary, Dr. Rourke.
My wife attempted to murder the clone which the rest of my family brought out of Zimmer's Himalayan redoubt. She succeeded in the attempt, but not to the degree she had intended. The clone's heart was undamaged, and the heart was needed to replace my own, which was irreparably damaged by a cyanide gas pistol.
You have to understand something, sir. John Rourke was unconscious, knew nothing about what was intended with his clone. All the rest of us...
That's enough, Emma.
No, it isn't, John. All of us took the responsibility. We were waiting in line to kill the clone in order to save John, and we'd do it again. You might care to remember that, sir, that all of us at this table, including Commander Darkwood, I believe, as well, would do anything for John Rourke.
Amen.
Touching. And true, I am sure. In that other way, Dr. Rourke, I truly envy you. Truly.
Annie Rourke Rubenstein wanted to hate Otto Kronberg and was frightened because she couldn't quite. They had retired to one of the assemblies of couch and chairs, John Rourke sitting in one of the easy chairs, directly opposite Kronberg again, Emma Shaw sitting on the arm of the chair beside him.
Dr. Zimmer's plan was marvelously devious, but a trifle too complex. Complexity in all of his dealings, one of Dietrich Zimmer's greatest faults. He considers obfuscation a mark of his genius. I consider it only a mark of his ego. At any event, Dietrich Zimmer assumed that no matter how he programmed Sarah Rourke, it would be exceedingly unlikely that she would actually attempt murder, and vastly less likely that she would succeed. And as you, Commander Shaw, and you, Dr. Rourke, indicated, she killed a clone, but did not attempt to kill the man Dietrich Zimmer so zealously tried to make her target. Dietrich Zimmer would certainly have been happy had she killed you, Dr. Rourke, but he was really hoping that she would not. What he wanted was for her to attempt it and fail. That was his greatest goal.
That doesn't make any sense.
Ah, but it does, Jew. You see, Zimmer's true desire was that you, Dr. Rourke, realizing what had been done to Sarah Rourke, would go to him, demanding that she be put aright. I do not believe that even Zimmer can erase such a memory without completely downloading the brain. You know, of course, that additional clones of Dietrich Zimmer and Martin Zimmer exist at Eden.
Shit!
I would have expected as much. Make your point, sir.
My point is that Dietrich Zimmer wanted you alive and under his control. He wished to download your brain into a clone, adding certain memories when he did so. Then he would have killed you, to be sure. Dietrich Zimmer wanted your mind, but altered, in order to become an instrument of his will. You would triumph over him as far as the world was concerned, and a grateful world would make you its leader, if you desired.
I have no political ambitions of any kind. Just the opposite, in fact.
You do not understand. It would not have been you, but a clone. A clone which was really a puppet. Your clone, controlled by Dietrich Zimmer, would have manipulated world politics to Dietrich Zimmer's ends. Eventually, Martin, whom Dr. Zimmer planned and perhaps still does plan to alter through something he can do with Adolf Hitler's remains, would have assumed control, appointed by your clone as rightful successor to world leadership. Dietrich Zimmer does not wish to rule over ashes, nor does Dietrich Zimmer wish to die. In fact, he is pathological in his desire for immortality, I think. Dietrich Zimmer's determination to live and rule is something which all of you must understand. You do not deal with some petty commissar, some Bolshevik madman. And I mean no offense to you, Fraulein Major Chemerovna.
None taken.
All of you deal with an enemy whose madness I have only recently come to fully appreciate. Madness and genius, both in unlimited quantity. Unbeknownst to the good Dr. Zimmer, I have gained full knowledge of his ultimate contingency plan. It bears the rather colorful-sounding codename of Operation Omega. Some, or all of you, are religious. I am not. But in the event that there is a God, I might suggest that you pray to him. Pray that we are able to derail Dietrich Zimmer's ambition before Operation Omega is set in motion.
Something worse to worry about than a nuclear war, the planet blowing up under us if we can't divert the volcanic rift in the Pacific before it hits the North American plate. What could possibly be more deadly than either of those options?
I will tell you, Jew. But first, a question. Commander Shaw?
Sir?
Did you participate in the raid on Eden Plant 234?
Yes, sir, I did. And I'm proud that I did.
That's of little importance, trust me. But it is the considered opinion of Allied intelligence that the biological warfare effort under Dietrich Zimmer's control has been damaged?
Our assessment is that it has been set back, temporarily. Why is it that you ask, sir?
The conventional biological warfare effort was indeed seriously damaged, perhaps more seriously than your intelligence estimates would suggest. But this situation is another matter entirely. All that it requires to be put into motion is in readiness, and Dietrich Zimmer will use that Omega option.
And just what is this Omega option?
Dietrich Zimmer controls an airborne virus capable of a wide range of mutations so that it cannot be countered by vaccines of any conventional nature. By the time a vaccine to counter the initial effects would be developed, let alone dissemination of the vaccine had begun, the virus would have mutated and the vaccine would be worthless. The virus, regardless of the mutated form it might take, remains equally deadly. The only vaccine effective against it, Zimmer has administered to himself. It has been administered to young Martin. It has been administered to their clones, his and Martin's, and theirs only. It has been administered to no one else. Dietrich Zimmer intends, if his back is put to the wall, to kill by means of the Omega option virus every living human being on the face of the planet. Higher animals might well be affected too. And once he unleashed this virus, it cannot be stopped. I learned of his plans only after I arranged for this meeting. Had you not agreed, Dr. Rourke, to evenly trade for my assistance, I would have volunteered this information at any event. I cannot stop Dietrich Zimmer alone. And if he is not stopped, only he and his son and their clones will survive. Once the virus has run its course, all mankind will be dead. Zimmer will then utilize the biological materials he controls, namely the cells from which he would be able to grow clones of all of you, with the exception of Commander Shaw and Darkwood, and whatever other cells he has decided to add to his bank of humanity over the years. He would grow a population, downloading into the brains of these hapless creatures the dogma, the philosophy which he considers the only acceptable way in which to think. Dietrich Zimmer would be the progenitor of the true master race, and from this breeding stock, all of the population of the world would spring.
Well, there's a glaring flaw in his plan. For a master race to exist, it must have other races to master, over which to feel superior. And he would have none.
The virus, Dr. Rourke, would remain virulent for centuries until it had exhausted all mutations possible and there was no living host, even remotely qualified within which it could thrive. While the Earth died around him, Dietrich Zimmer's scientific research would go on. I have examined other data.
From what source did you obtain this data?
Men loyal to me kidnapped one of Dr. Zimmer's chief technical assistants. The man was more interested in his life than his loyalty, shall we say. There was a charming term used during your 20th century, hacking. He entered Dr. Zimmer's computer network. To have destroyed the data found there would have been useless, however, since the same fellow advised that all files were backed up and saved on CD-ROM disk, these stored independently of any computer.
What were his other plans?
Dr. Zimmer has worked in an area which might best be labeled degeneration of the human species. The good doctor is well aware of the fact, Dr. Rourke pointed out, that a master race needs an inferior race over which to rule. And there will be great amounts of labor to be accomplished in a new world. There will be building to be done, roads to be built, menial tasks which must be accomplished for the advancement of the civilization which Dr. Zimmer foresees. Dr. Zimmer has laid the groundwork for the culturing of a race of human-like creatures, but of subhuman intelligence. Deprived of the ability to speak, to learn beyond simple tasks, expendable creatures who can be reproduced at will asexually by means of cloning alone. This is the world envisioned by Dietrich Zimmer. And none of us at all has a place in it. Your bodies, Dr. Rourke, Fraulein Major, Frau Rubinstein, young Rourke, and perhaps even yours, Jew, and, of course, the body of Sarah Rourke, would be the basis for the genetic material used in the development of both the master race and the slave race.
We will have to confirm, of course, what you're saying, Lieutenant General. But assuming that we are able to do so, I would take it that we should act very quickly. Were I a betting man, I'd say that relatively shortly we'll be hearing from Dr. Zimmer's people, offering us the use of the tactical nuclear warheads. As you say, Kronberg, Zimmer would not wish to die, and if the volcanic rift beneath the Pacific isn't somehow prevented from reaching the North American plate, the planet is almost certainly doomed. All of Zimmer's plans would be for naught. It's in his best interest that we prevent the rift from reaching the North American plate. Once Zimmer learns we are onto his true plan, however, he'll release his virus. In fact, if we succeed in stopping the spread of the vent beneath the Pacific, that may well be Zimmer's signal to release the virus. We must somehow halt his plans and kill him and all the clones he possesses of himself and of Martin.
And Martin, Doctor?
Martin must die as well. Let's adjourn for 2 hours, then resume. James, we can't trust a radio frequency of any sort. Get Lieutenant General Kronberg, I assume he'll be willing, to assist you to speak with this technician of Zimmer's and get Allied intelligence to hack into Zimmer's computer network and confirm what's been said here. Is that all right with you, sir?
Of course.
James, after you and Lieutenant General Kronberg have conferred, take the V-stole you came in. Fly out of here, directly to Midwake. All of us will join you there later, with the exception of Lieutenant General Kronberg, unless he wishes our protection.
I think not, Doctor.
Your choice, sir. At any event, time is more truly of the essence than it has ever been in human history. There's work to do. Natalia, as soon as Michael's through getting the data he needs from Lieutenant General Kronberg, you and Paul get together and get every detail you can concerning where Dietrich Zimmer is headquartering now. Start working up the outline of a plan. Emma, you get some sleep, because you'll have some flying ahead of you sooner than we expected. Annie, consult with General Stada and his people about security here. Get him to double whatever he has. If Zimmer suspects we're having this conference, he'll hit it.
John picked up the telephone receiver from behind the bar.
Yes, General Stott, please. No, sir, everything is fine, just fine. My daughter has a matter she'll be working with you on in a few minutes. But I need a line to Allied Intelligence Headquarters in Hawaii at Pearl. Have your communications people rerouted as much as possible and scramble all transmissions from here. Get someone on that, if you would, then my daughter will meet with you at the front doors as soon as you feel you'll be ready.
You be careful. If Zimmer does know where we're at, he'll have nothing to lose.
I'm always careful.
Paul Rubinstein's eyes moved over the room. Already, Darkwood and Kronberg were conferring. Natalia was smoking a cigarette, sitting otherwise motionless, as if she were on pause, waiting. Paul Rubinstein walked toward the bar. James Darkwood was already en route to Midwake, carrying with him the means by which he could gain access to Dietrich Zimmer's computer network, the pertinent data, something Kronberg had committed to memory and subsequently divulged. Kronberg looked tired. Natalia and Paul had already begun organizing data Kronberg gave them concerning Dietrich Zimmer's current operational headquarters in a well-fortified, all-but-nuclear-bomb-proof bunker outside Eden City. Annie had security for the conference upgraded, insisting that General Stott put the Icelandic Defense Forces on full alert. She ordered airborne, canceling Emma's sleep, the second V-stall, so that if its landing at Lidveldid Island had been detected by the Nazi or Eden war machines, so would its takeoff. The V-stall would return for them at a pre-designated time. John Rourke himself had spent much of the two-hour period in direct telephone communication with Allied Intelligence Headquarters in Hawaii at Pearl Harbor. Then, in a three-way call, including Thorn Rolvag, aboard the deep-sea exploration vessel, the Dauntless. The Dauntless was home-base to the deep-dive submersibles, many of them remotely driven, which prowled over the volcanic vent itself, monitoring its progress by every measurement method possible. Indeed, Dietrich Zimmer's overall military commander, a man named Helmut Anton Grimm, had contacted Allied headquarters, offering a temporary truce while this threat to all mankind was combated and committing the full complement of Nazi and Eden tactical nuclear warheads. Martin Zimmer personally contacted the President of the United States, pledging Eden's full efforts for the good of mankind. As John Rourke related this last, Natalia couldn't believe it.
Yet in a very real way, the surrender of the tactical nuclear warheads will achieve its effect, hopefully. By the same token, it would seem exceedingly likely that Dietrich Zimmer has given up on his other plans and is moving to execute his Omega option. Kronberg, tell us whatever you can recall concerning the method or methods by which Zimmer plans to disseminate the virus. Any jump we can get in pre-planning before we access Zimmer's computer network will help us.
I will tell you whatever I can, Doctor. As I said, it is an airborne virus. All I was able to see concerning it, I'm not particularly gifted in the field of epidemiology, was that he will release the contents of several hundred canisters of the gas which are already in place in major population centers throughout the world. There is likely at least one, perhaps several, right here in Liedvelded Island. Eden's involvement with international shipping by means of the Russian traders has been quite significant, and for better than two decades. I have no way of knowing how long Zimmer has had this plan in place. It would seem likely that canisters were shipped all over the world to be detonated remotely when and if Zimmer required.
And what about the nature of the virus?
What does it do to the affected person? I have no idea, Frau Rubinstein. I consider myself quite literate in my native language, but the terminology was beyond me.
You know Zimmer better than any of us, Kronberg. Give us your best guesstimate concerning his timetable for actual release of the virus. Would he wait until the operation to combat the volcanic vent is completed? How long before the viral agent would take effect? Do you have any knowledge whatsoever of that?
Fräulein Major, as to his timetable, I will hazard a guess. As to the time required for the virus to begin its work, I have no way of knowing. Again, I have no skills in medicine, and most of what I was able to read was beyond me. And since we stayed in Dr. Zimmer's system for only a brief period of time, lest we should be discovered, there was no time to copy any of the material. Frankly, I was looking for intelligence data which might be of some assistance in deposing Dr. Zimmer. We came across this data by sheer accident and had no idea what to do with it. Yet, realizing its importance, we exited his system immediately and have not re-entered since. But, as to Dr. Zimmer's timetable, I would say that he will have all in readiness, waiting only for completion of the project to divert the volcanic vent. When he is certain that the world will indeed survive, then he will have no further use for the world's population.
Annie, get Emma's plane back here. Have her make arrangements for another aircraft, destination not to be disclosed on the air, in order to get Lieutenant General Kronberg back to the Pacific Northwest safely. How will we stay in touch, Kronberg?
Commander Darkwood and I have a system for doing so.
Makes sense. The system, John. It'll work.
All right.
And now, Dr. Rourke, I would pose a question to you.
And the question is?
You are a medical man, I know, and therefore more the man of science than I. A two-part question, really. Is it truly possible that Dietrich Zimmer's Omega Option virus could, in fact, kill everyone on the planet? And what will happen if the volcanic vent cannot be stopped by your own best estimate?
I'll try to answer both questions. The vent. Let's take that one first. If we fail, the vent will stop against the North American plate, causing pretty much all the other volcanoes on Earth to erupt. And that will mean mass extinction on a planet-wide basis. And as to your other question, to the best of my knowledge, medical science has never licked a virus. The common cold, that's what we called it in the 20th century, was really an entire system of rhinoviruses. Flu virus was another example. The best we could do was to soften the blow of the symptoms and build up an immunity, but only if we knew the character of the virus in time. But with a virus designed to rapidly mutate, there would be no defense which could be devised in time to do any good. Perhaps a handful of persons might survive, naturally resistant by some fluke of nature. Perhaps, too, the immunologist and some small group might be able to rapidly re-immunize so that they would survive. But in essence, Dietrich Zimmer would obliterate humanity for all time. I suggest that we be on our way.
He had become accustomed to the constant darkness and the rain of ash which covered everything in sticky gray, but he would never become accustomed to the constant trembling of the ground beneath his feet. The walls of Tim Shaw's office had become so badly cracked, along with the rest of the headquarters building and better than 50% of the buildings in Honolulu, that people were conducting business from their cars. He was conducting police business, and business was too good. The sabotage was all but ended, coinciding with the time that the ground began shaking. When the tremors began, news, in a diluted form, in order to avoid wholesale panic, was released in the general media concerning the suboceanic vent. Nothing was said of the possible consequences for total destruction. Yet somehow, it was as if people knew. The announcement was made a little over a week ago, when the earthquakes kept coming and coming and never stopping. Fortunately, none of them was powerful, yet. This last weekend, attendance at churches, synagogues, and other religious gathering places in the islands reached an all-time high. For everyone who had turned to his or her own personal idea of God, there was someone who had turned away from good entirely, it seemed. Robberies, looting, killing, vandalism, arson. The litany was unending, and for cops, so was the work, as reflected in Shaw's quiet briefing of the people under his command on the Honolulu PD SWAT team.
With what's happening, we don't have time to tuck around. We've only got 24 hours in a day, and everybody's working 12-hour shifts or better as it is. Pretty soon we'll be living in our cars in the SWAT vans. So, as if we didn't already have enough to do, the chiefs assigned us to assist the regular street cops in anything that amounts to a major crime. Essentially, when the artillery comes out, so do we. That being the case, although I've always told my son Eddie to make certain that a substantial part of your training was in how to act like a gentleman and shit like that. Anyway, if we're called in, we get the job done as fast as we can so we can be ready for the next one. If it means smoking a perp that after 6 hours of negotiation we might be able to talk into surrendering, but probably not, we smoke the perp so long as we can do it safely for any innocent civilians involved.
One of the guys, Gene Wells, raised his hand.
Gene, speak to me.
Tim, you're telling us to kill people?
Nothing like that at all, Gene. So I'm glad you brought it up. I wouldn't order you guys to kill anybody. I'm saying we don't have the time to futz around. If the opportunity is there, of course we talk through. But if it's a matter of being shorthanded on the next call, and one of our guys may be getting killed damn straight, we end it quick. We serve and protect. It doesn't mean we're supposed to be human sacrifices. All right?
It was potentially human sacrifice time again. Tim Shaw heard the radio call. There were three, possibly four, armed robbers holed up in a building which had already been vacated because of tremor damage, stealing computers. When they tried getting out the back door and into the alley and were spotted, there was a fight. A security guard shot and killed, and two civilians wounded. A third civilian was able to return fire and had wounded one of the perpetrators, with blood to prove it all over the alley floor, according to the dispatcher.
This is Honolulu, Kilo Lima, 21, en route, 10-4.
Eddie would be there, exhausted as hell, just like everyone else. Although it seemed that half the people in Honolulu had turned into bad guys overnight, in reality, the criminal population hadn't soared. It was just that more crime was being committed in a shorter period of time. In a standoff this morning with two guys who'd robbed a bank 2 days ago, both perpetrators, now deceased, turned out to have records going back to juvenile. Maybe the usual criminals were accelerating their activities because they wanted to live their idea of the good life in what might be the last few weeks or months anybody would be living at all. Or maybe they were scared, just like the people who went to church and the people who didn't change their lives at all. And committing every crime they could think of was a way of crowding back reality, not having to think about what was going on under the ocean and why the island they lived on was trembling so badly and why the volcanic ash kept falling and the rains kept falling and the whole damn world seemed to be going crazier than ever before. Maybe killing a perp was doing him a favor. He wouldn't have to sit and wait around for death like everybody else. So maybe that was why crime was increasing exponentially. Because Tim Shaw was privy to information that hadn't been given to the general public. Dr. Thorne Rolvog and his colleagues were predicting that the Pacific vent would collide with the North American plate in approximately 14 days. It might be days or weeks or months after that, but if the vent reached the North American plate and split, the world would end. Eddie would be dead. Emma wouldn't get to marry John Rourke, or even if she did, she wouldn't live long enough to have children. Everybody would just be dead and gone. Maybe that was why Tim Shaw didn't worry that he was driving a little fast. People were working under awnings and improvised tents, their portable telephones in hand, laptop computers beside them, cold rain and gray volcanic ash blanketing everything around them. Cars, normally parallel parked on Lord Boulevard, were parked diagonally so that there would be more spaces. Inside almost every car, there were people, sometimes three or four or five, doing as best they could what they would have done in the abandoned buildings flanking both sides of the boulevard. The park itself, which ran down the center strip, was a tent city. Half blocking the northbound lanes of Lord Boulevard were three prowl cars and a SWAT van, most of Eddie's people, rather than being deployed, trying to get the area clear of civilians. Gray mud was everywhere, covering everything, dripping off the tent roofs and awnings, clogging the sewers, puddling in every depression. Eddie was in the doorway of the abandoned building, a high-rise office complex less than 5 years old. Tim Shaw remembered watching while it was being erected, but no building was made for constant earth tremors, maybe a dozen times a day, day after day. Tim Shaw stood next to his son.
Druggies stealing the computer so they can peddle them to buy more shit. That's the way it looks. The descriptions of the men fit and the merch they were trying to boost wasn't anything special, worth maybe a couple $100 tops.
You trying to talk to them, Eddie?
Yeah, they won't talk. We know where they're at. Had a remote probe scan the building, got the thermal signatures on the fifth floor. Three men seem to be able to move around, and the fourth one is lying on top of the desk or something. They're fucking idiots, Dad.
Well, sure they're fucking idiots, Eddie. What'd you expect? You need a rest, boy. How long you been on duty?
Not too long, Dad. I'm fine.
Okay, look. Let's get this one over quick, and then maybe grab some dinner and some Z's, huh? You up for that, Eddie?
Unless some other damn fool does.
Well, worry about that when it happens, Eddie. Remember what your mom used to say. Sufficient unto each day is the evil thereof. Remember that? Burning yourself out isn't going to make this volcanic vent shit go away.
I'm all right, Dad, for God's sake.
Hey, you're in such hot shape, fine. We'll give the rest of these guys a vacation and we go get these assholes ourselves, huh? What do you say?
We could get ourselves killed.
So, you want to stay alive? Good. Smart boy. Then cut out this no sleep and no food shit. That's a good way to get yourself killed. And you got a right to do that. You don't have any right to get your guys killed just because you're too washed out to be sharp. Now get me three guys that can still stand up. After this, we all go to La Vita's for pizza. SWAT gear and all, leastways it'll probably keep the place from being robbed.
All right.
Good, get me three guys.
Hey.
Hey what?
How long you been up?
I'm always up. That's why I'm such a killer with the babes, Eddie. Now get your ass out of here.
Tim Shaw closed his eyes for a second, telling himself not to fall asleep. With Eddie, Jean, and two other guys from the SWAT team, Tim Shaw at last got himself into position on the fifth floor. Eddie was monitoring the remote probe that was still circling the building. The positions of the three men who could still move around were pretty much the same. Two by the windows and the front entrance to the office suite they occupied, and one by the rear door and the stairs, where Tim Shaw, his son, and the three SWAT team members waited. The thermal signature of the fourth man was getting less intense, which could mean the fourth guy was dead. Judging from the blood on the stairs, there was a good chance of that.
The guy by the back door is walking around a little. Maybe he's bored.
Him and me both. Gotta liven things up a little, fellas. I tell you what, Gene, take Bob and Richie and cover us. Eddie, go lay an entry charge on the lock plate. Eddie and I go in and nail the guy by the back door. Gene, Bob, Richie, you guys cover us, then move in right after us. Get into position on the other two guys. And don't forget the wounded guy on the desk. Might still give us some action. Just before Eddie and I go in, Bob, you flip a sounding light grenade in there. But make sure we're clear, because he's a new slack somewhere. And throw in a tear gas.
Eddie moved toward the doorway, Tim Shaw covering his son, as did Gene, Bob, and Richie. Laying the entry charge, it would blow the lock plate off and maybe a hole in the door, took under 45 seconds. Tim Shaw pulled on his gas mask, the goggles inserted into the mask self-adjusting and designed for use with sound and light grenades.
Signal the guys in the street to do their number and then give me a hand signal. We count to 10 and Eddie detonates the charge and we go. Ready?
Shaw watched Gene's lips move as Gene spoke into the radio. Gene gave a thumbs up. Tim Shaw nodded his head as he counted, the others doing the same. At 10, Eddie activated the electronic detonator for the entry charge. The .45 in Tim Shaw's right hand and the little snubby .38 revolver in his left, Tim Shaw started for the still-smoking doorway, Eddie already in motion, one of the Lancer copies of a Remington 870 12-gauge in both fists at high port. Eddie was through first, Tim Shaw behind his son in the next second. Tim Shaw's eyes involuntarily squinted against the flash. The gas grenade rolled across the floor. Tim Shaw was still running. No bullet had hit him yet. The top of the desk splintered away. The perp behind the desk was in motion. Gene, Bob, and Richie streaked past them. There was a man with a shotgun. He stood up from behind a desk just as calmly as if he hadn't a care in the world. Eddie fired first. The bad guy stumbled back a pace but didn't fall.
Eddie, look out, man!
The bad guy was already bleeding to death, but Bob shot him with a long burst from his subgun. Gene dropped to his knees beside Eddie.
Jesus, he's bleeding bad, Tim! Get a medic, dammit! Fucking hurry, Richie!
The man on the desk wasn't dead yet, proving it as he sat up like some corpse in a horror movie and sprayed a subgun at Gene, catching him in the thighs and bowling him over. Bob shot the nearly dead guy in the face. It was all going bad. The bad guys armed better than Tim Shaw or anybody had thought. Gene and Eddie were more tired and out of it than Tim Shaw had ever imagined. The last bad guy was standing by the main doors of the office suite, a subgun in each hand.
Fuck you, cocksucker!
Then Tim just closed his eyes, but only for a second. His son was bleeding to death at the other end of the office. Eddie wasn't going to die. Tim wanted to kiss the doctor. There would be no pizza at La Vita's. With Eddie and the others who'd gone down, none fatally, thank God, no one was in the mood for anything even remotely like that, least of all Tim Shaw himself. And La Vita's roof caved in during a tremor which occurred about 5 minutes after the gunfight in the office building. The hospital, like all public buildings, was built to stricter codes and so was still habitable. But plaster walls were spiderwebbed with cracks, and the personnel in the hospital looked like they were about to crack a little as well. Once Tim Shaw was certain that his son was all right, and the others as well, and that no one had sustained any crippling damage, except the bad guys, and they were dead anyway, he excused himself and left. His car was parked back at the crime scene. He'd ridden in the ambulance with Eddie. It was a lousy night for a walk, so he hailed a police car on its way back from the emergency room. He knew the cop behind the wheel, had known her father, too.
So, hear your SWAT guys had a bad time of it, Inspector.
Pretty bad, Linda. Could have been worse. A lot worse.
Ask me, it's gonna get a lot worse, I mean.
Well, we get too many more earthquakes, we'll just slide off the friggin' island. We won't have to worry about it.
Where to?
Over on Lord Boulevard, near this Tilton building. Left my car there.
Hope you locked it.
Tim Shaw leaned back, pulling his hat down low on his forehead. His eyes on the street as soon as she turned into it.
We all gonna die, Inspector?
What? Like, I look like some kind of prophet or something? We just gotta hang in there. Don't be scared.
I am scared, I admit it.
There were people living in tents along the street here. The tents, sometimes just blankets and tarps strung together. Sometimes the tents the military had provided. But these, few and far between. As they drove, he could see figures moving within the makeshift tents, silhouetted by the light against the fabric. People standing or sitting, looking like they were talking or sometimes maybe arguing. He saw a couple embracing, too. His own apartment was holding up okay, and he wasn't about to sleep out in the rain until the walls started falling down on him.
Being scared don't help, kid. There's nothing wrong with being scared. It's normal. You'd be an idiot not to be.
You don't look scared, Inspector.
Neither do you.
But then the ground began trembling, the streetlights flickering. She pulled over to the curb, her little hands locked tight on the wheel. Tim Shaw put his arm around her.
You mind?
No. I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry, kid.
When the ground stopped trembling, Linda didn't.
You near the end of your shift?
In an hour.
Call in. Tell them you need the car. Tell them I relieved you, officially.
Can you do that? Anyway...
Yeah, I can do it. And don't give me any arguments. Eat any dinner?
No.
Neither did I. Would you say we fixed that?
Are you asking me out to dinner, Inspector?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I am. And if you accept, you better start calling me Tim.
Tim.
She moved his arm. She sniffed.
So get on the radio and tell him you're off duty as of now.
They left her car at his place, taking his car as they searched for a restaurant. Every restaurant they tried was closed because of structural damage or a power outage. These days, almost all power was routed underground by a sophisticated fiber system, and the loss of electrical power was so rare that a lot of people didn't even own flashlights. But the underground infrastructure of power, water, telephone, and the like could only take so much battering, and there were sporadic outages. Most of these still caused by problems within the walls of the battered buildings, not by a failure of the system. They had been driving around for better than an hour.
My apartment's in good shape. If you can cook, there was a supermarket open a couple of blocks back. You up for it?
That'd be nicer than a restaurant anyway.
Look, I just don't want you getting the wrong idea. I'm no dirty old man or anything.
I know that.
The supermarket was out of a lot of things, like bread and milk and bottled water. Panic buying, he figured. But the real essentials, beer, pasta, and things like that, were in good supply. His arms laden with two grocery bags, they took the stairs to his apartment. He'd given Linda the key so he wouldn't have to fumble with it.
Was all the damage fixed up after those guys...
The saboteurs? Yeah. Got a new bathtub. Walls fixed the whole nine yards. Got some new furniture, too. Department even paid for some of the damage, but not much of it.
Tim followed her inside, and she set his key on the table beside the door.
Kitchen's this way. Ditch the raincoat and grab a beer.
Linda hung up the raincoat, her gun belt on beneath it, and followed him into the kitchen. Having no idea whether or not she could cook, the absence of testicles didn't necessarily confirm the presence of culinary talents, as he'd learned a long time ago. He'd picked out stuff that was so hard to screw up, even he could cook it. Putting the bags down on the counter, he started packing beer into the refrigerator, leaving out two.
You need a glass?
Whatever.
Fine, less to wash.
Tim took off his hat, his raincoat, and his suit coat, depositing all on a kitchen chair, retrieving his little .38 snubby from the raincoat pocket first and putting it on the counter. His .45 was still stuffed into his waistband, holsterless as always. Linda unbuckled her gun belt, setting it on the counter, then took off her radio. It was already shut off.
So, place isn't so bad, huh?
Your apartment looks nice. You're lucky you're in a structurally sound building. I'm in a building like this, but one of my girlfriends... She works for the university, you know. Well, her place is almost in ruins. She moved in with me at the beginning of the week.
Want to give her a ring? Let her know not to worry?
She never expects me. Ever since the tremor started, my hours have been worse than ever, just like everybody else.
Why don't I put your gun in the living room?
Please.
Tim picked up her rig. He hadn't worn a duty rig for more years than he wanted to remember. It was heavy for a girl her size.
Carry a backup gun?
I remember the course you used to teach at the academy, Inspector. Tim, I mean. You gave us a list of the best backup guns I bought from the list. Lancer copy of the Seacamp DA-32 in my side pocket.
Good girl.
Tim got rid of his raincoat, suit coat, hat, and the .38 along with her duty rig, then returned to the kitchen. The .45 was still in his waistband, just like it would have been if he'd been home alone. He didn't see any reason to behave any differently than he normally would have, except maybe to watch out for belching if he had too much beer too fast. Even though she was a cop, she was a lady. Part of his enjoyment was to make the woman do things which disgusted her, humiliated her. Mary had been sobbing uncontrollably for better than an hour, and that was upsetting him.
You're ruining everything, Mary. Stop crying or I'll hit you again. Maybe this will help it then. Oh!
Mary was really trying hard not to cry. He gave her that. But evidently, she wasn't trying hard enough.
I will keep hitting you until you stop crying. Learn to control yourself. The longer you keep crying, the more I'll punish you, and the longer this will go on. We could have been done almost an hour ago.
His father, Dietrich Zimmer, was right. People were weak, needed purpose, direction. This girl was the perfect example of that. She had no self-control, couldn't even put up a fight of any sort at all. She was ruining the whole thing. If she didn't stop crying pretty soon, he would call in Elder Watts and have her taken off, useless thing that she was proving to be. They could find him another girl, just grab one off the street for him so that he could finish. He didn't like starting something that he couldn't finish, and with her crying like she was, he was too distracted even to do anything to himself. Dietrich Zimmer sat at one of the computer terminals. He had acquired all of the data which was currently possible to obtain concerning the suboceanic rift which was crossing the Pacific, moving inexorably toward the North American plate. The logic of the plan the Allies had suggested by John Rourke, expanded upon by the scientist Thorn Rolvag, was sound. But application of theory was often a different case entirely. As a scientist himself, he knew that from bitter experience. During a laboratory experiment under controlled conditions, if something went wrong, one merely started over again. The laboratory here was the planet itself. If the Rolvag theory did not work, the planet would be doomed, just as doomed as it would have been had nothing been tried. No one could accurately judge, past the stage of computer models, what would be the result of detonating tactical yield nuclear warheads along a volcanic rift. Would the detonation indeed vent off the pressure and prevent the spread of the suboceanic rift? Or would it merely accelerate the linking of the areas of volcanic activity which comprised the Pacific Rim's Ring of Fire? Were the latter to be the case, the planet would be destroyed all the faster. If the planet were destroyed, he had lost. The fallacy ingenious, however great, was that one was still dependent on outside forces. For once in his life, Dietrich Zimmer would exercise no control. If the planet could be saved by means of the practical application of Rolvag's theory, then he, Dietrich Zimmer, would institute the Omega option and rule forever. If not, like everyone else on the face of the Earth, he would die, although he held the key to immortality. Before sitting down to dinner, Tim Shaw checked with the hospital on the condition of his son and the others. Their conditions were unchanged, which meant that they were doing well. Dinner was satisfying. Linda, not the best cook in the world, but more than acceptable. They talked cop for a while, then about the tremors and the volcanic vent which was probably causing the problems in the first place. After a while, over another brace of beers, he realized that they were intentionally avoiding talking about themselves. When dinner was over, they cleaned up together, stashing the unused pasta in the refrigerator, each taking another beer. The time was getting late. They sat on the couch and talked some more.
I guess I'm staying kind of late. Better get going.
Yeah, getting kind of late. I mean, you know, hey, what's late for a cop? Hey, look, you want another beer or maybe some coffee?
She edged forward on the couch seat, perching there almost in thin air, and she looked at him.
Do you want me to stay?
Yeah. I want you to stay. I'm too old for you.
I don't care, Tim.
Damn it, neither do I.
Her fingers drifted along his chest, along his neck, touching at last at his face.
You need a shave, Tim Shaw.
I need a lot of things, kid.
Boris Jones, the son of an immigrant Russian girl and a college professor in Honolulu, may not have been the best American computer expert. But if he wasn't, James Darkwood had no idea who could have been any better. Whenever there was something genuinely difficult involving computers, Boris, a civilian, was called in by the Navy to handle it. Living and teaching at Midway, Boris was also convenient. James Darkwood leaned over his shoulder now as Boris entered Dietrich Zimmer's network.
You guys are lucky that somebody gave you the entry keys for this.
I never told you that.
You didn't have to. Even I'm not smart enough to have broken into this thing. Whoever put together the entry system is a genius. Certifiable.
He's certifiable, all right, but not necessarily the genius part.
Shit, James. Each pathway into the system has three ways to go. If you don't know which is the correct choice, you could follow a maze-like blind alley for minutes, maybe hours. And even if you had part of the entry key and didn't do the rest, you'd still be screwed. It's like a Chinese puzzle box. You can say what you want, but the guy who developed this is smart with a capital S, and that's the truth. This is Dietrich Zimmer's system, isn't it?
What would make you think something like that, Boris?
Well, for one thing, you never told me whose system we were breaking into. That's a good indicator that it's a really high security level. And I speak, read, and write perfect German, which is another clue. I hope we can copy what we find that you want, because I don't command enough technical German to be able to understand what you might want to know. And neither do you, although your German's about as good as mine.
Just get into the computer, huh, Boris?
Oh, this guy is really good. You make one wrong step and the system kicks you out. I bet you that if you make enough wrong steps, the system shuts down. This is the ultimate burglar-proof entry system. If this is Dietrich Zimmer, he should quit being a dictator and just design stuff like this. He could make a fortune. Nobody'd get through this without knowing how first. I guarantee it.
Are you getting through?
Yeah, but you have to be really careful with the protocols, because I bet that if you make a typing error, the system kicks you out. And that's what I'd do with a system like this. Want to try it?
No, for God's sake, Boris. This is important, man.
Just pulling your leg, James, that's all. The only thing I hope is that there isn't a time limit on entry. You guys should have told me about this and given me the entry keys beforehand so I could practice with them. But we're in it now and there's no turning back. Onward and sideways.
James Darkwood's eyes were beginning to blur from the unending array of equations, line after line of them, which would flash onto the screen, have to be answered, and then immediately flash off. If Boris screwed up and they didn't get in, would the system automatically alert Dietrich Zimmer that someone had tried entering and failed? If that were the case, Zimmer could cancel all of his programs and entry into the system would be useless. More and more, espionage was like that, playing computer games, as opposed to clandestine meetings and forays into enemy territory. Sterile, but still exciting somehow. When it all became this way, if it did so during the term of his naval career, he'd have to apply for sea duty. Although he'd passed all the required courses at the academy and all the other courses he'd had to take since, talking with computers was something he did poorly.
Holy shit. My technical German notwithstanding, this is talking about some kind of virus with controlled mutations.
Just copy it, Boris. If you read it, I might have to kill you.
What?
Just kidding.
But James didn't know whether or not he was. Professor Wilhelmina Krauss, New Germany's premier authority in medical German, was very quietly spirited away from her home in New Germany with the help of the German authorities in such a way that her disappearance would not, everyone hoped, attract attention. By transatmospheric insertion flight, she would be arriving in Hawaii within the hour, James Darkwood was informed. She would then be flown by V-Stall to her undersea rendezvous at Midwake. The number of printouts of the data gleaned by Boris Jones from Dietrich Zimmer's computer network was strictly controlled. The data, the CD-ROM disks to which it had been committed, and the means by which Zimmer's network could be accessed, locked in a special vault at Naval Intelligence Headquarters for Midwake. Six Marine Corps guards, rifles locked and loaded, were standing watch over the vault itself. Security for the building doubled. Although Professor Krauss did not know it yet, she would remain under guard once her work was finished, and until the data she was able to provide them concerning the virus had been acted upon. James Darkwood left word at the security desk that he should not be disturbed in his temporary office, and that he should be awakened in 45 minutes. Sleep would be a progressively more scarce commodity, and he would get what he could while he could. John Rourke, Emma Shaw beside him, Annie, Natalia, Michael, and Paul around him, walked with the naval escort toward the steps of Naval Intelligence Headquarters. It was always spring at Midwake, plants always in bloom, trees always green, something always new and fresh. Midwake had begun as a top-secret project under joint control of NASA and the United States Navy in the years before the night of the war, as an attempt to develop beneath the sea the practical working environment for space, while at the same time providing a base for United States submarines, which would be within convenient striking range of the then Soviet submarine base at Cam Ranh Bay in Vietnam. When the night of the war came, the people living and working at Midwake, supplemented by the personnel from what submarines were able to reach the facility, formed the racial stock from which the city beneath the sea had grown. That stock was as wonderfully diverse as the United States itself had been, a wide range of racial, ethnic, and religious backgrounds represented there. Indeed, it was at Midwake that Paul Rubinstein, more than a century ago, had discovered that he was not the only remaining person of the Hebrew faith to survive the night of the war and the great conflagration. Utilizing the same technology which was being developed for building a modular station in orbit over the Earth, Midwake was able to expand on its own tenuous self-sufficiency in order to become the successor to the name United States of America. A parallel program begun by the Soviet Union was discovered, and beneath the sea, World War III raged for five centuries. Submarine warfare unlike any ever conceptualized by William Bourne, a British mathematician and writer on naval subjects who in 1578 published Inventions or Devices, describing a completely enclosed boat that could be submerged and rowed underwater. Bourne never actually constructed this boat, but Dutch inventor Cornelis Brebel is usually credited with building the first submarine. Between 1620 and 1624, he successfully navigated crafts designed after Bourne's creation beneath the surface of the Thames River. It is said that King James I took a short ride in one. Midwake survived. Its communist counterpart was conquered, and with peace at last, however short-lived, the population of Midwake in part returned to the surface. Most of the current residents of Hawaii were descendants of the men and women of Midwake.
It's like coming home every time I come here. Like being some kind of space traveler in a movie or a book returning to my home planet.
John Rourke squeezed Emma's hand. It was, of course, unmilitary that they should walk hand in hand here, she in uniform, but he was a general in the United States Forces, appointed to the rank more than a century ago here at Midwake. Although he didn't take the rank as more than honorary, at times like this he was glad that rank, however unearned, had its privileges. They ascended the steps, armed Marine Corps guards in camouflage BDUs, rather than dress blues, manning guard posts at the doors. John Rourke and his party were allowed entrance, the sailors who had escorted them thus far falling back. Inside the main doors, there was a vast hall. On the floor at its center, as a mosaic, was the Great Seal of the United States. Beyond its boundaries was a large desk, manned by three Marines, two women and one man, all in dress blues, but all with sidearms. Rourke stopped before the desk, the Marines saluting him, Rourke returning their salutes, then taking the identity badges for all in his party, passing them to the appropriate persons whose faces and names appeared on the badges. And as if on cue, elevator doors within the bank of four just past the desk opened and James Darkwood stepped out. In uniform, when Darkwood neared them at last, he stopped, came to attention, and saluted. John Rourke smiled, returning the salute and suppressing his laughter.
If you would accompany me, General?
Certainly, Commander.
Rourke walked toward the elevators, letting Darkwood fall in beside him, Emma dropping back a pace.
Let's cut this formal crap once we're about our business, all right?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Professor Dr. Wilhelmina Kraus had very beautiful blue eyes, nearly as surreal in their blueness as Natalia's. And she was a meticulous woman, with prepared notes in several notebooks beside her on the desk into which the consoles were set. There was an exactly appropriate number of chairs set about the room. John Rourke waited until the women were seated, then seated himself. Within the room with them was the President of the United States, the Ambassador of New Germany, the Ambassador of Australia, the Ambassador of Lidveldet Island, and the representative of what had been called the Wild Tribes of Europe, now simply known as Gallia, after the Latin term. The Russian ambassador was unable to attend and would be briefed by her counterparts.
I feel so very little among you. I am but a university professor, and I sit with the leaders of the world and the legendary John Rourke.
It is we who are honored, Fraulein Doctor.
My English is not so good as my command of my native language, especially at the technical level. And so I apologize in advance. I have reviewed the materials provided me, although it would take many days of study to understand all that is included here, I think. My medical specialty is not epidemiology, and such experts must indeed be consulted by you at once. What is represented here is most grave indeed.
Could you tell us, Fraulein Doctor, just what it is which we face?
Horror, sir, is what you face. You and all of us. The materials presented to me outline a plan so despicable that I sicken at the very thought of it. Dietrich Zimmer has revived a disease from the distant past and made it more virulent than nature could ever have made it. It would be unstoppable.
AIDS.
Exactly. He has reinvented the disease known as acquired immune deficiency syndrome, modifying the HIV virus in such a fashion that it can be transmitted in the very air that we breathe, in the very water that we drink. He has modified it in such a way that the virus will almost constantly mutate, therefore be unstoppable. Every disease possible for mankind to contract will be contracted, and the body's immune system will not fight back. People will die from diseases which have long since ceased to claim human life. The cure for most types of cancer, which was developed almost 200 years ago, will no longer be of any effect, because this cure must work in conjunction with the body's own immune system. common viruses, such as those which affect the upper respiratory system, will become man-killers. Dietrich Zimmer must be the devil incarnate to do this to humanity.
We're talking about the calculated murder of the human race.
Dietrich Zimmer has developed a means by which to immunize against the permutations of the virus and administered this immunization to himself and to Martin Zimmer and to what are referred to as clones of themselves. He has perfected the process of human cloning. This man would unleash this horror then?
He is evil, Fraulein Doctor, beyond human imagining. He's obsessed with his own immortality and with his own mastery of the planet. Nothing else matters to him. I propose that we briefly adjourn while the Fraulein Doctor rests a bit and we get some epidemiologists in to assist her, if that meets with your approval, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, of course. We should do that. Let's break for dinner, then. Would you join me for dinner, Fraulein Doctor? I promise that we will not discuss this matter. I'll show you the aquarium, or what I call an aquarium. It will relax you, I promise.
Thank you, Mr. President.
John Rourke stood up as she stood. He was suddenly more angry than he had ever been in his entire life, and more committed to a single purpose than any since he had set out across the nuclear wasteland 6 centuries ago in the immediate aftermath of the night of the war to find his wife and children. He would take the life of Dietrich Zimmer or die in the attempt. Midwake was a full-fledged community, even more now than it had been when John Rourke first came here over a century ago in the belly of Jason Darkwood's submarine, near death after being captured by the communist forces beneath the sea. There were fine restaurants, and John Rourke picked what James Darkwood had told him was the very finest. Despite the fact that he was dressed in rough clothes and Emma Shaw in her flight suit, and even the waiters wore tuxedos, John Rourke and Emma were seated immediately. He was, of course, John Rourke. The thought at once amused and bothered him. Seafood was an obvious specialty, but John Rourke was not terribly hungry, and Emma seemed even less so, so he ordered the fettuccine Alfredo and a house salad for each of them.
He's insane.
Obviously.
Can he do this? I mean, really do it?
Yes, he can. And more to the point, Zimmer will.
We have to stop him.
Again, obviously.
How, John?
Kill him before he can release the virus if he hasn't already released it. In either event, kill him and rid the world of him forever. In the 20th century, there was considerable debate over the morality of a death penalty for capital crimes. I was always firmly convinced that the death penalty was not a deterrent to crime, merely a cure of sorts. Fear of death would not stop a murderer from taking the life of his victim. The only demonstrable benefit inherent to capital punishment was that the murderer or other capital criminal could never be released onto the streets, could never commit such a crime again. Death was the only way to make certain of that. Lifetime incarceration was not only impractical, but could prove impermanent. Dietrich Zimmer has stepped outside the human community to such a degree that in murdering him, there would be no more moral import than in shooting at a paper target.
Can you get near enough to kill him, John, without...
Without getting killed myself?
Yes.
I'm going to contact Wolfgang Mann and see if the divorce papers which Sarah had filed have been cleared yet. If they have, or the moment that they have, be my wife for as long as that is. And then afterward, if there is an afterward.
Yes.
Thank you.